Section 2.5. What is biodiversity and why does it matter? Up to this point, the chapter has mostly discussed nature and natural systems in technical terms relating to ecosystems, matter, and energy. The Gulf of Mexico case study helped illustrate how these terms apply to a specific environmental problem. But the more important goal of providing this foundational knowledge is to enable you to more fully explore the critical concept of biodiversity. When human activities disrupt ecosystems, as well as energy flow and matter cycling in those ecosystems, biodiversity suffers. As a result, human well-being suffers too. As discussed in Chapter 1, biodiversity is a measure of the variety of life and organisms in a specific ecosystem. The overall biodiversity on planet Earth is truly amazing. Some biologists estimate that there may be as many as 100 million species on the planet, although most estimates range from 7 million to 10 million. Credit Zimmer, 2011. Of that total, only about 2 million species have been identified to date, suggesting that there is still much we do not understand or appreciate about the diversity of life on Earth. This section will further define and explore biodiversity and why biodiversity is so important. Section 2.6 will review some of the major threats to biodiversity around the world and what is being done to address them. How ecologists characterize and measure biodiversity. Ecologists typically characterize biodiversity in four different ways. First, and most common, is to measure biodiversity in terms of species diversity, or the number of different species and their relative abundance in a given ecologic community. As previously discussed, species diversity tends to be highest in the tropical regions of the world and decline toward polar regions. In addition, hundreds of scientific studies conducted in different regions of the world have demonstrated that higher rates of species diversity are associated with both increased productivity in ecosystems and greater resilience in response to stress. Credit Tillman, Isbell, and Cowles, 2014. For more on this issue, see the feature box called Apply Your Knowledge: How Does Biodiversity Improve Ecological Resilience? Second, genetic diversity refers to the variety of genes and genetic material found within a population or species. Generally, the more genetically diverse a population is, the better the chance that population will survive and adapt to environmental changes. This is because increased genetic diversity improves the likelihood that some members of a population will have genetic traits that enable them to withstand disease, drought, or some other form of stress. Those individuals are then able to pass along those genetic traits for future generations. Genetic diversity can be viewed in much the same way that investors approach portfolio diversity. By not putting all their eggs in one basket, they are able to maintain their portfolio, even if some of their investments do not do well. A third way to think of biodiversity is in terms of ecosystem diversity. Ecosystem diversity refers to the different types of ecosystems, forests, wetlands, grasslands, and so on, found around the world. Because different ecosystems support different assemblages of species, it's generally the case that higher rates of ecosystem diversity will result in greater species diversity. Different ecosystems provide us with different types and forms of critical ecosystem services. Recall from Chapter 1 that ecosystem services are life-supporting services provided by the natural capital or natural infrastructure of ecosystems. These include water filtration and nutrient cycling. Higher rates of ecosystem diversity result in a greater variety and volume of ecosystem services provided to us by natural systems. Lastly, ecologists use the term functional diversity to describe all of the different ways in which organisms interact with and make use of a specific ecosystem. It's generally the case that an ecosystem with high levels of species diversity will also be characterized by high rates of functional diversity. This is because different species obtain food, reproduce, use resources, and generate waste products in different ways. Understanding of functional diversity is important to the study of ecosystems and biodiversity because it provides greater insight into the actual behaviors and actions of different species and how they relate to one another within that ecosystem. Apply your knowledge. How does biodiversity improve ecological resilience? Michigan's Isle Royale is a 72-kilometer-long or 45-mile-long island located near the Canadian border in Lake Superior. Due to its unique location, the island remains somewhat isolated from the U.S. and Canadian mainland, and researchers use its relatively simple ecosystem to study several North American species interactions. Taking a closer look at the flora and fauna on Isle Royale can help us understand how biodiversity can make ecosystems more resilient. Isle Royale hosts a variety of familiar North American species, many of which traveled to the island by air, water, and ice long ago. A mix of coniferous and deciduous trees supports primary consumers like squirrels, hares, birds, and moose. In marshy areas, aquatic plants provide food and habitat for beavers, fish, and aquatic insects. Foxes eat some of the smaller critters on Isle Royale, but the top of the food chain is occupied by wolves. Wolves are the only creatures that regularly prey on the formidable moose populations inhabiting the island. A simplified food web in Figure 2.9 in your ebook highlights some of the major species interactions on Isle Royale. Take a moment to study this ecosystem and consider the variety of ways that these organisms depend on one another. Each species carries out vital functions for the larger ecosystem. Some organisms represent food sources for others. Some keep specific populations in check through hunting and consumption. Beavers engineer habitat, and ravens consume carrion and redistribute nutrients. Every one of these functions is essential to the larger ecosystem and the life that it supports. In some cases, there might be several species carrying out these ecosystem functions, and in other cases, there might only be one or two. According to the food web in Figure 2.9 in your ebook, how many primary producers are providing food for primary consumers? How many predators are controlling the primary consumer populations through predation? Which of these two ecosystem functions will be more resilient if future environmental changes disrupt the ecosystem? We can see from the food web that several forms of vegetation provide food sources for primary consumers. This gives us an idea of how this part of the ecosystem might respond to future changes. For example, if the balsam fir population was wiped out, the other forms of vegetation might still be able to provide suitable food and habitat for the ecosystem. In this example, the moose population appears to have several other food options. The top of the food chain is a very different story. If wolves were to disappear, there would be no other species around to keep moose populations in check. This ecosystem function would go away completely, and it would dramatically impact the entire ecosystem. A scenario like this occurred on Isle Royale in the 1970s, when humans introduced a disease that nearly wiped out the wolf population. The moose population exploded, leading to overgrazing and the destruction of forest habitat. With fewer moose kills to redistribute nutrients, forest soils also became less fertile. Before wolf populations could recover, a lack of forage and a rise in moose ticks led to a crash in the moose population. The entire Isle Royale ecosystem was thrown out of balance by just a single species, and populations are still recovering today. Variety is a good thing for most ecosystems. If you have several species accomplishing a specific task, the ecosystem will be more able to cope with the loss of one or two of those species. Isle Royale has relatively low levels of species biodiversity, especially at the top of the food chain. As a result, the ecosystem underwent massive changes when a new disease was introduced. How biodiversity occurs. Ecologists attribute the amazing diversity of life on Earth to processes of natural selection and evolution. Natural selection refers to a process whereby individual organisms within a population are better able to survive because they possess certain genetic traits. These individuals will reproduce and pass those traits on to their offspring. The result of natural selection is evolution, the process whereby the genetic makeup of populations of organisms changes gradually over time. The combined processes of evolution through natural selection is widely accepted as scientific theory, in part because it can be observed happening in the world today. For example, when farmers apply chemical insecticides to their fields to try to wipe out crop-destroying pests, they typically succeed in killing perhaps only 90 to 95% of that population. This is because some individuals possess unique genetic traits that make them resistant to the insecticide. Those few survivors then reproduce and pass that resistance trait onto their offspring. After a few generations, the insect population begins to bounce back, as the same insecticide proves less and less effective against the now resistant population. More on this problem in Chapter 4. Farmers then have to switch to a new insecticide or try something else to avoid having their crop destroyed. An interesting form of evolution is what ecologists refer to as coevolution. Coevolution is defined as a process whereby two different species that interact closely, such as a predator species and a prey species, also evolve together in a series of genetic changes. Two examples will help illustrate coevolution. One involves a coevolutionary process that benefits both species, that is, it's mutually beneficial. In the other, coevolution occurs as one species seeks an advantage over the other. In the first case, there are a number of examples of tropical fruit-bearing trees co-evolving with fruit-eating birds, to the benefit of both. These trees have evolved to grow brightly colored and easy-to-see fruits that are also relatively odorless to avoid attracting insects. These fruits tend to be difficult to eat on the branch and come in a form that birds can swallow whole. After ingesting the highly nutritious fruit, birds move to other regions of the forest and eventually either regurgitate or defecate the seeds, enabling new fruit tree growth. In contrast, some species evolve to try to fool or discourage predation by other species, leading the prey species to also evolve in what some ecologists refer to as an evolutionary arms race. An example of this form of coevolution involves the rough-skinned newt and the common garter snake. The rough-skinned newt secretes a toxin through its skin, known as tetrodotoxin, or TTX, the same toxin found in blowfish. TTX is extremely toxic, and a single newt can secrete enough of this toxin to kill multiple humans. Newts have evolved to produce this toxin in order to discourage other organisms that might prey on them. In response, garter snakes that share the ecosystem with rough-skinned newts have also evolved to develop a resistance to TTX. Over time, newts have evolved to secrete ever more TTX, and natural selection has favored the snakes that have kept up through an even greater resistance to this toxin. How biodiversity impacts species interactions and ecosystem functioning. The diversity of species within an ecosystem influences how species interact with one another. As described briefly earlier in the chapter, different species occupy different ecological niches within an ecosystem. You can think of a niche as an organism's place in an ecosystem, including the kinds of food it eats and places it lives and reproduces. Some animals, known as generalists, are more adaptive and flexible than others. Other animals, referred to as specialists, have very specific niches. For example, raccoons are often cited as an example of a generalist species because they are found in so many different places and can subsist on so many different types of food sources. In contrast, koalas are only found in a limited area where they can access what is virtually their only food source, eucalyptus leaves. An organism's niche will often be an important factor in determining the ecosystem's carrying capacity for that species. The carrying capacity is the number of individuals in a population that an ecosystem can support without degrading the ecosystem. Generally, the broader the niche, like that of a raccoon, the greater the carrying capacity. Ecologists also classify species by whether they are native or non-native. Native species include plants, animals, and other organisms that exist in a given location through natural processes, such as natural selection and evolution. In contrast, non-native species are those that are introduced to an area intentionally or accidentally. Some non-native species find an ecological niche in their new habitat that is not disruptive to the native species that were there before them. However, other non-native species can be extremely disruptive and either compete with or prey on native species. These disruptive non-native species are usually referred to as invasive species. For example, the mongoose is a small but voracious predator that was introduced from Southeast Asia to Hawaii, Central America, and South America to help control rat populations. However, the mongooses did not limit their hunting to rats, and they have been blamed for declines in bird, reptile, and small mammal populations in these areas. Two other important categories of species are indicator and keystone. Indicator species can be thought of as an early warning or alarm species. Their absence or presence is an indication of a change in environmental conditions. For example, certain types of aquatic plants, like eelgrass, water lily, and purple loosestrife, are known to be sensitive to water pollution. Their presence or absence is an indication of good or bad water quality conditions. Keystone species are critical species in an ecosystem, and their absence can affect other species and even alter the entire ecosystem. Keystone species are named after the keystone in an archway, without which the whole arch collapses. An example of a keystone species is the sea otter. Sea otters feed on sea urchins, and sea urchins feed on underwater kelp forests, which provide habitat to many forms of marine life. In locations where sea otter populations have declined due to hunting, pollution, and diseases spread from land, sea urchin populations have been able to grow. The greater number of sea urchins led to destruction of kelp forests, which in turn affected other species and the entire ecosystem. Keystone species are usually the apex predators in a particular food chain, meaning that they are at the top of food chains, with no natural predator of their own. When the population of a keystone species declines or is eliminated from an ecosystem, it can have serious ripple effects on the rest of the organisms in that food chain. This is known as a trophic cascade. Recall that each link in a food chain is a different trophic level. Why biodiversity is important. Biodiversity is important to human well-being and survival. As previously discussed, ecosystems with high rates of biodiversity are more productive, better at providing important ecosystem services, including those critical to food security and water quality, and better able to withstand environmental change and disturbances like drought and pest infestations. Biodiversity is a source of many products and services that most of us depend on directly. For example, it's estimated that over half of all modern medicines have been derived or based on compounds found in nature. This list includes medicines like penicillin, cortisone, and paclitaxel, which are used as antibiotics, birth control, and treatments for inflammation, cancer, and arthritis. Biodiversity is also the basis for entire tourism and recreational hunting and fishing industries. These activities generate billions of dollars in economic activity annually. Finally, biodiversity can be said to have value to humans for its sheer existence. Individuals might not ever expect to see an elephant or orangutan in their lifetime, but they still might derive joy from simply knowing that such species exist. environmental economists refer to this as existence value, and they cite as evidence the millions of dollars that individuals donate to nature conservation causes. Ecologists and ecological economists sometimes divide those ecosystem services that directly benefit humans into different categories. These include supporting services, like photosynthesis and primary production, provisioning services, like seafood or lumber from forests, regulating services, such as natural water filtration by trees and forests, and cultural services, such as recreational tourism and existence value. We can clearly see that biodiversity is a form of natural capital. It provides us with services, products, recreation, and spiritual enjoyment, without which we cannot survive. Given biodiversity's critical importance, Section 2.6 will review the major causes of biodiversity decline. It will also discuss steps being taken at the local, national, and international level to support and preserve biodiversity. Section 2.6, Threats to Biodiversity and What Can Be Done About Them. Long before humans began wandering the earth, new species of insects, birds, plants, mammals, and amphibians emerged, while others went extinct. Many of these extinctions occurred during one of five mass extinction events that happened millions of years ago. These mass extinction events were triggered by massive volcanic eruptions, asteroid impacts with Earth, or extreme changes in climate. Since then, extinctions continued to occur naturally, but at a gradual rate that ecologists refer to as the background extinction rate. Today, as described in Chapter 1, we are in the early stages of a sixth mass extinction event. However, the primary causes of this current spike in extinction rates, far beyond background extinction rates, are due to human actions and activities. Threats to biodiversity. The major threats to biodiversity and major causes of extinction are habitat destruction and fragmentation, introduction of invasive species, overexploitation, pollution, and climate change. The most damaging of these is habitat destruction. Deforestation, draining wetlands, and conversion of grasslands and other open spaces to farms and residential developments are all examples of habitat destruction. The links between habitat destruction and biodiversity loss should be obvious. Because animals are adapted to specific ecological niches, they often cannot respond to the destruction of their habitat by simply moving somewhere else. Because of this, generalist species are more likely to withstand destruction of their habitat compared to specialist species. Habitat fragmentation refers to the breaking up of large areas of habitat into smaller and smaller fragments. Habitat fragmentation disrupts food webs, alters reproductive activities, and can even change the microclimate of an ecosystem, all of which can lead to biodiversity decline and extinction. Invasive species are another major cause of biodiversity decline and extinction, for reasons described earlier. Some invasive species are introduced to a new environment by accident, while others, such as the mongoose, have been introduced with some specific purpose in mind. Either way, invasive species can outcompete or prey on native species to the point of extinction. Humans have long hunted, fished, and trapped wild animals for food and other necessities, as well as collected plants and other materials to meet their survival needs. When these activities are undertaken on a scale and in a time frame that allows populations to recover and stay relatively constant, they can be considered sustainable. However, over the past 200 years, and in many places around the world, these activities have started to occur on a scale that is not sustainable, resulting in what ecologists refer to as overexploitation. Perhaps the most famous example of extinction due to overexploitation is that of the passenger pigeon. These birds were once so widespread over the American Midwest that giant flocks of them would literally darken the sky as they flew overhead. It's estimated that there were once between 3 billion and 5 billion of these birds. And in only a matter of decades, they were hunted to complete extinction for their meat. Other examples of overexploitation include overharvesting whales for meat, poaching elephants and rhinos for ivory, and even overharvesting ginseng root from forested regions of Appalachia for export as a medicinal plant to Asia. Pollution and climate change are the final two major causes of biodiversity decline and extinction, in addition to eutrophication, see Section 2.4, pollution from oil spills, acid mine drainage from coal mines, and sedimentation from agriculture and land clearance for housing and commercial developments can all impact biodiversity negatively. Climate change is affecting species directly and indirectly. For example, polar bears rely on floating sea ice to help them reach their most important food source, Arctic seals. However, because of climate change, there is less sea ice for the polar bears to use. And as a result, some populations of this species are in decline. Elsewhere, climate change is altering habitat, disrupting migration cycles, and modifying animal behavior in ways that are hindering the ability of some species to adapt and survive. Again, these changes tend to have a more serious impact on specialist species than generalist species, since the former are usually less able to adapt. As factors like habitat destruction, overexploitation, and climate change impact biodiversity, ecologists use a variety of categorization systems to rank just how threatened a particular species might be. A group called the International Union for Conservation of Nature, or IUCN, has developed a database of at-risk species and regularly publishes what it calls the IUCN Red List of threatened species, which names those species at greatest risk. The IUCN Red List currently includes over 23,000 species that are considered critically endangered, threatened, or vulnerable. Current rates of extinction are estimated to be as much as 100 to 1,000 times higher than normal or background rates. See the feature box called Learn More, The End of Nature? And this is why many ecologists are worried that we are entering a period of a sixth mass extinction. Learn More, The End of Nature? On May 6, 2019, the United Nations Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, or IPBES, released a report stating that human actions are transforming the planet and driving species to extinction at unprecedented rates. The 1,500-page report, written by 145 expert authors and based on a review of 15,000 scientific studies, represents the most comprehensive review ever undertaken of global threats to biodiversity and the impact this could have on human civilization. While the IPBES report stressed that it is not too late to make a difference, the key takeaways from the document are sobering and staggering. First, the report estimates that as many as 1 million species of plants and animals are threatened with extinction in the coming decades, more than at any other time in human history. This includes more than 40% of amphibian species, almost one-third of coral reef species, and over one-third of all marine mammals. Second, human activities have now altered over 75% of the global land surface and over 66% of marine environments, transforming habitat and leaving less room for other organisms. Third, climate change and pollution are already driving species to extinction. For example, marine plastic pollution has increased 1,000% since 1980. And has reached a level that now threatens 86% of marine turtles and 44% of seabirds. The IPBES report does not put a direct dollar value on what the extinction of 1 million species would mean for us, but we know enough about biodiversity and ecosystem services to know that human societies would be impacted negatively and severely. A loss of this many species in such a short time would have ripple effects across many economic sectors. Agriculture could be negatively impacted by the loss of pollinating insects. See the feature box called Close to Home, Protecting Pollinator Biodiversity at the end of this section. Fisheries would be impacted by the loss of marine habitat and keystone species. Recreation and tourism could be devastated as formerly pristine areas are increasingly impacted by human actions. And overall, we know that a loss of biodiversity reduces ecosystem productivity and resilience. With hard-to-predict impacts on a wide range of ecosystem services critical to human well-being. The IPBES report calls for immediate and bold action to address this biodiversity crisis. Recommended actions include investments in protected areas and conservation, stepped-up efforts to slow climate change, and global cooperation to address transboundary environmental problems, like marine plastic pollution and the transport of invasive species. More information on the IPBES report can be found in the links provided in your ebook. Taking action. Recognizing the importance of biodiversity to human well-being, ecologists and other environmental scientists are advocating a number of approaches to address biodiversity loss and extinctions. These approaches include government action at the national and international level, as well as efforts by businesses, community organizations, and individuals. Within the United States, the Endangered Species Act, or ESA, has played an important role in addressing the biodiversity crisis. The ESA lists both endangered species, considered to be in imminent danger of extinction, and threatened species, those that are at risk of becoming endangered. There are currently over 1,300 ESA-listed species. The ESA restricts the direct harvest or overexploitation of these listed species, as well as activities that might impact or destroy their habitat. Well-known ESA-listed species include the grizzly bear, jaguar, manatee, sea otter, sea lion, polar bear, blue whale, killer whale, gray wolf, California condor, and northern spotted owl. While the ESA has had some notable success stories, including the bald eagle, it is not without controversy. Property rights groups argue that the ESA interferes with the rights of individual landowners. Conservation groups argue that the ESA is too focused on protecting individual species, rather than broader habitats and landscapes that support those species. Either way, since it was enacted in 1973, the ESA has played an important part in addressing the biodiversity crisis in the United States. At the international level, there are a number of agreements designed to help protect biodiversity, including the Convention on Biological Diversity and the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. The Convention on Biological Diversity has three interrelated goals: conserving biodiversity, promoting the sustainable use of biodiversity, and ensuring that the benefits of biodiversity are shared equitably. The Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, is more narrowly focused on prohibiting and regulating international trade in endangered species. One of the most important accomplishments of CITES was the 1989 ban on international trade in ivory, which helped slow the decline in populations of African elephants. Today, scientists working under the CITES structure use DNA testing and other forms of forensic science to track down and prosecute individuals involved in illegal trade in endangered species. Besides legal and regulatory action to protect biodiversity, there are other steps being taken to address the challenge of species loss and extinction. For example, the Forest Stewardship Council, or FSC, is an independent organization that certifies forest management operations as sustainable. Individual consumers and businesses purchasing lumber and other forest products, including coffee, with the FSC label, are helping promote forest management practices that protect biodiversity. A similar certification effort related to seafood is known as the Marine Stewardship Council. In regions of the world with high rates of biodiversity, ecotourism can be a way for local communities to benefit from the conservation of nature, and often includes the establishment of nature wildlife preserves and other protected areas. Lastly, there is an entire field of science focused on restoration ecology, an approach to habitat management designed to reverse environmental degradation and restore ecosystems to conditions more favorable to biodiversity. Close to home, protecting pollinator biodiversity. Honeybees often come to mind when we think of pollination, but pollinators are far more diverse than many of us realize. For example, hoverflies, plasterer bees, Mexican long-tongued bats, and monarch butterflies are all wild pollinators. Unfortunately, many wild pollinators are threatened, and pollinator biodiversity is in decline. Industrial farming and invasive plant species have replaced native vegetation, making it difficult for wild pollinators to find food. Similarly, ecosystem destruction and fragmentation from human development have reduced the amount of food and habitat available. Pesticide use and drift from aerial spraying is another major threat to many insect pollinators. So, what can we do to reverse some of these trends and support the native pollinators where we live? First, let us meet a few wild pollinators and see if we can get a better sense of what their needs are. Hoverflies can be seen hovering around the nectar and pollen sources that they feed on. Like many wild pollinators, they prefer to feed on the native plant species that they evolved alongside. Some hoverfly larvae also eat aphids and other pests. In other words, a good alternative to using insecticides is to plant native flowers around farms and gardens to attract those pollinators that prey on pests. The plasterer bee takes its name from the smooth interior walls of its underground nests. This kind of habitat is not at all uncommon. The vast majority of pollinating bees live in the ground, hollow plant stems, and woody cavities. They tend to thrive in places that have some bare soil, shrubs, and dead wood to provide habitat. If we want to support a variety of pollinating bees, we need to make sure that they have good places to nest. The Mexican long-tongued bat depends on plant varieties with larger flowers than most, and one of its main food sources is nectar from agave plants that are native to the southwestern United States. The Mexican long-tongued bat demonstrates that different pollinators require different flowers to thrive. If we want to encourage a variety of wild pollinators, we need to make sure that they have a variety of flowers to choose from. Perhaps the prettiest wild pollinator is the North American monarch butterfly, which is also famous for its annual migration to overwintering sites in Mexico. These creatures need to fuel up in the late fall before their 4,800-kilometer or 3,000-mile journey south. So flowers that bloom at this time are particularly important to their survival. Like monarchs, many wild pollinators have seasonally specific nutritional needs, and they require flowers that bloom at the right time or times. Now that you have a better sense of wild pollinator needs and the specific activities that are leading to biodiversity declines, take a moment to plan a theoretical garden for your hometown that would give local pollinators an extra boost. Are there ways you could provide a greater diversity of food sources and habitat? Are there ways that you can avoid using harmful pesticides? Most importantly, is it possible to act on your plan around your home or in your neighborhood? If you want to get serious about protecting wild pollinators, visit Pollinator Partnership at pollinator.org. This nonprofit has created planting guides and other online resources to help you create pollinator-friendly yards and gardens. Section 2.7, Planetary Boundaries. Human-induced environmental change is not necessarily a new thing. Ancient Maya and Roman civilizations were responsible for deforestation of large areas, and agriculture in a region known as Sumer resulted in soil degradation and the collapse of entire communities. However, the kind of human-induced environmental change and destruction we are witnessing today are fundamentally different from those of the past in three important ways. First, the pace of change is much greater now than ever before. Chapter 3 will show how human populations have grown slowly over thousands of years before exploding to over 7.7 billion today. Population growth and technological advances have prompted us to extract and consume far more resources per person than ever before. The net result is that environmental change is happening far faster than ever before. Second, the scale of environmental degradation and change has gone from mostly local and regional to global. The phrase global environmental change is relatively new, and it's only in recent decades that the cumulative impact of human actions began to be felt on a global scale. Third, the type of environmental change we are witnessing today is different from environmental changes of the past. Modern environmental problems are persistent. They compound one another, and more of them have the potential to be irreversible over time. For example, each year the chemical industry develops about 1,000 new compounds and produces over 90 million metric tons of chemicals in the form of 70,000 different compounds. Only a small fraction of these compounds are thoroughly tested or really understood before they are released to the environment. In the past, human actions were just one of many factors shaping ecosystems and the world around us. Today, they are the dominant influence on the environment. This is why some refer to the current period as the Anthropocene. To better grasp what the scope of human impact is, a group of scientists with the Stockholm Resilience Center in Sweden developed the concept of planetary boundaries. Planetary boundaries are intended to provide a framework for developing a safe operating space for humanity with respect to global environmental conditions. You can think of planetary boundaries in the same way that you and your doctor might consider things like blood pressure, blood sugar, weight, cholesterol levels, lung function, heart rate, and other health indicators. Doctors measure and monitor these indicators to determine if a patient might be at risk of health problems or even death. Likewise, planetary boundaries are a collection of 9 Earth system processes with associated safe and unsafe operating spaces. These 9 Earth system processes include the following. 1. Stratospheric ozone depletion. 2. Biodiversity loss. 3. Chemical pollution. 4. Climate change. 5. Ocean acidification. 6. Freshwater consumption. 7. Land use change. 8. Nitrogen and phosphorus flows to the biosphere and oceans. And 9. Atmospheric aerosol pollution. Of these 9 measures, the scientists with the Stockholm Resilience Center estimate that we have already exceeded a safe operating space in 3 areas: biodiversity loss, climate change, and human interference with the nitrogen cycle. Other areas of concern include ocean acidification, interference with the phosphorus cycle, fresh water use, and changes in land use. Returning to the analogy of the doctor, the planetary boundaries exercise tells us that we are putting the health of the planet at risk, and this could have direct consequences for our own health and well-being. Of particular concern is the possibility that we may soon be approaching thresholds or tipping points with respect to some of these indicators. This could result in feedback loops that reinforce and worsen initial conditions, eventually leading to irreversible environmental change. The hope of the group involved in developing the planetary boundaries concept is that we will heed the warning signs and begin to do more to address critical environmental challenges like biodiversity loss before it is too late. Bringing it all together. The goal of this chapter was to provide you with a solid foundation in ecology, to prepare you for some of the material presented in subsequent chapters. it is especially important that you understand how ecosystems are defined, how they function, and how the organisms found within them interact and interrelate with one another. This includes grasping the key concepts of energy flow through ecosystems and matter cycling within ecosystems. The Gulf of Mexico Dead Zone case study helped illustrate how these ecological concepts can be applied to real-world environmental challenges. This chapter also focused on helping you develop a better understanding of what is meant by biodiversity, why it's important, and why it's under threat. According to the concept of planetary boundaries, biodiversity loss is one of three indicators that our actions are already pushing past safe limits. Chapter 3 will explain the role that population growth and material consumption play in bringing about this situation. Subsequent chapters will take a closer look at specific environmental challenges related to things like food, water, and energy. For additional web resources and a list of key terms, please visit your ebook.